Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, everyone. Hello. Welcome back to My Good Bad Brain. I'm going to keep this intro pretty short because the episode's decently long. This is going to be the first of, I'm just going to call this season three. We're starting season three. Yes, season two is only like 12 episodes, but we were spending some time thinking about things, figuring things out. I don't know. Season three. Why am I calling this season three? Well, it's a new year. And also, it's kind of a new format. And this I thought would be a nice one to kick it off with. It's these live streams we've been doing on mixer.com/mygoodbadbrain. We've been doing a live stream every Sunday morning. For the last few weeks, it's at 10 a.m. Pacific time. Again, mixer.com/mygoodbadbrain. And it's me, but it's also Dr. Nicholas Barr, who you may remember from an earlier episode a while ago. He's one of the few professionals I've had come on the show to talk about basically trauma processing. He's an experienced social worker, traumatologist. He was also on Allie's podcast, Ologies, the traumatology episode. And that's a wonderful, very real podcast, you know, very good, good in research and fun. And anyway, Nick's amazing. And he's teaching right now in Las Vegas. And I asked him about this, whatever. Long story short, he's into this idea. And we wanted to create a way basically to, you know, everyone talks a lot about like, it's hard to get mental health care. It's hard to find mental health access and information. And Nick's a professional, he's a doctor. And so, you know, in the interest of me realizing, I guess that to me, the best part of a good bad brain is this creation of solidarity and community and things like that. We thought maybe we try making somebody who has a lot of professional knowledge more accessible to everybody. And so this seems like a good way to do that. So we're doing this live stream now, and it's, you know, we've used to take questions from y'all. And this was our third one, but it was the first one that I didn't have really any technical issues and the sound came out nice and clean. And also we got some great questions from people. So I thought I'd like let this be the first of our, we're going to call it season three of this new format. I'll still do brain breathers once in a while. And, but I want to try this for a bit. I think this is really great. So that being said, if you have any thoughts or topics or questions you'd like us to discuss on upcoming episodes of My Good Bad Brain in the live stream sort of way of me or Dr. Nick, probably more Dr. Nick, then you can send them to mygoodbadbrain@gmail.com or hit me up on my Instagram and stuff. I do have Good Bad Brain Instagrams. I'm on the Jared Sleeper Instagrams more often, that Twitter, stuff like that. But yeah, that'd be great. So anyway, I'm gonna chill out on this. I'll just say too, I know there's a lot going on. We'll talk more about COVID-19 stuff and this week, but I just as a side note, just health in general. Check out the Ologies episode this week. It was, you know, virology. We talked to a virologist primarily, but there are no less than four ologists that show up in that episode. And Allie does like her journalist best on this one. I mean, going to primary sources, and there's just a ton of great info about virus stuff. And I know it's stressing me out, it's stressing everybody out, and knowledge is power. So go check that out, the Ologies episode, Virology, this week. It's like a COVID-19 special mega episode. And there's all kinds of stuff about the nature of the virus and how that works and sanitizing. And we talked to the disasterologist about just sort of like disaster planning and how people act and things you can do. And it's great. It's a great episode. So oh, and of course, Merlin Tuttle makes his appearance, which I don't know if whatever. He's a bat expert, and he's just wonderful because bats are getting a lot of blame for this that maybe they don't deserve. Anyway, All right. Thanks, y'all. I'm going to shut up and I'm going to let the tape run from last Sunday, and I'll be doing this. Join us this Sunday, please. 10 a.m. If you like doing a little self-care stream with us. Yeah, I mean, you're probably going to be in quarantine anyway, so tune in. Thanks, guys. Mixer.com/mygoodbadbrain. And then, of course, as usual, Patreon.com/mygoodbadbrain. If you'd like to support the show, mygoodbadbrain.com. If you want merch, lovely. All right. Leave us a review. I don't know. Okay. Thanks. Here we go. On with the show. Bye. Me and Nick. See ya.
Welcome to my good bad brain. I'm a normal person, so I'm insane. I've got depression and ADHD, but I'm doing better since I medicated me. I'm still not always sure whether I exist or what being a person even really is, but I figured out a long time ago that being alive is beautiful.
How are you, Nick? How are you? Good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you, man. How's everything going?
You know, fine. I think, like, as good as they can be. I think, like, there's politically, there's a lot to get freaked out about, and there's, like, coronavirus and stuff, and, you know.
What's the vibe like in LA? Is it, are people freaked out, or is it people wearing masks?
I'm not seeing a lot of masks. I'm definitely not seeing a lot of masks. I think the message got out about masks, though, that masks don't do much. I do feel like people are like canceling big events and things like that, or not really gathering.
You know? There's conferences are getting canceled left and right.
Yeah, I mean South by Southwest got canceled, which is crazy. Yeah. What?
I was just being an asshole. I just said tragedy.
You know what's funny about it is it's like, for some people it's like a big deal because. Poor artists, I friends, not to like.
Yeah.
Well, actually, because my friend was like, he's like, oh, a bunch of my friends who have shows or like somebody had like a short film was gonna premiere there, and they're like, oh, I guess it's not now, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, but no, it's just strange that it's like in the air and like along with all the other stuff, you know, like are we dealing with it? Coronavirus is like. I feel like Allie and I were talking about the other day, like, you know, climate change is way more existential threat than, you know, than like this temporary virus thing.
Yeah.
But that there's something about this virus that's like, you know, the thing they always say, like, oh, wearing your seatbelt is more important than, you know, screening for terrorists. Like, you know, you die in car crashes. You don't die from like the airport, you know?
Right.
But like people, one's like a scarier, a more like romantic problem that's like front and center in your brain. So you think about that instead of the other one. It feels like that, like climate change is too like imaginary or too like lengthy or too ephemeral until it's not, you know, the time it takes for the hurricanes to happen or whatever. So, but like this virus feels immediate enough and romantic enough that people are like, oh no, we have to prep, you know?
I think there's like genetic memory of contagion fear too, you know, just well, I don't know if that's a real thing, but yeah, I feel like there is, I mean, from an, you know, it would make sense from an evolutionary perspective that the idea of some unseen contagion is like strikes deep in the bones, you know, whereas the idea of some of these more abstract things is hard for people to grasp.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I don't know. It's just strange. I the part of that conversation started because we were like, oh, it feels like weird that people are actually making changes about this almost, which actually, I don't know. Well, I have questions kind of related to that today from some people, but, let's throw to you. Do you have anything going on in the world of psychology, mental health stuff that we should be aware of that you want to talk about this week?
Well, the only thing I want to mention briefly is I think, you know, I don't know, you know, and maybe people might know that one of my research interests is mindfulness, like mindfulness as a kind of protective factor in the context of trauma exposure. But there's a lot of evidence to suggest that kind of similar to physical exercise, mindfulness practice has a host of benefits for a range of issues and problems. So I was, without getting too deep into the political quagmire, I was just looking up kind of the normative curve for development of brain disorders related to aging.
Yeah.
And I just was reminded of a couple of studies that show that meditation practice, just like basic attention, focus on the breath type meditation practice, has benefits for ameliorating cognitive decline.
Oh.
So not that meditation is going to somehow cure Alzheimer's. That's not the case. Right. Just that it helps to improve some cognitive scores as we age.
That makes sense to me. I mean, yeah. I think like it does. I mean, use it or lose it as a general principle seems to be like pretty accurate. The older I get, the more I notice it with physically for sure. And then I think it's, I don't know. I always hesitate because now I have a professional here, so you can tell me if this is true or not. But I feel like it's always been important to me to remember that my brain is a physical organism as well. That like it'll be ruled by some of the same, because it's so easy to think of my thoughts and my feelings and my emotions, my perceptions as something non-physical, like, you know, but to confuse that with like, I don't know what I'm trying to say, like something, consciousness is something that doesn't seem physical. You know what I'm saying? But like understanding that the things that shape that consciousness or inform that consciousness are utterly physical. Anything I smell or taste or see, and then as a result, anything I think is like made in my brain. And so like with physical stuff, it becomes very apparent. Like, oh, when I stop lifting, like pain comes back into my knees that wasn't there before when I try to do it again or whatever. Like if you just continue, and you can see that in people that age, if they've continued to be physical their whole lives, that doesn't, they can still kind of move when they're older. And so it stands to reason that your mind, you know, if you keep using it, if you try to like, you know, very intentionally focus on it, on things, consider things, and just, you know, run your brain through its paces, that would help it.
Yeah, you gotta run your brain. I mean, the thing also is there is really good evidence to show that physical exercise is one of the best predictors of brain health into older really? Adulthood. Yeah, because think how complex and difficult it is, how demanding on the brain it is to manage all these physiological systems when you're at arousal, like during exercise.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean.
Oh, that is interesting. Because I also noticed that when doing more like complex physical movements or like poses in yoga or certain like, you know, Olympic lifts or kettlebells, things like that, if they're more complex. Sometimes it's very taxing on your nervous system. Like I always think burpees, the move where you drop for a push-up and then jump up and you know, reach your hands overhead, they're so much more exhausting than if you only did a jump and a push-up and a squat, like, and added them together. There's something about like the whole thing that seems to uniquely tax your nervous system. So that's interesting. I never thought of that like it would also be working out your, literally be working out your mind, like that you know, all the connections it's making are demanding.
Yeah, you're running a demanding program, you know, so it's computationally demanding.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. And that was a very that was a gentle introduction without going into why you might be thinking about ways to stop cognitive decline as you get older. All right. So I got some questions from listeners today. I want to start with a few. One of them, I'm going to start with this first one just because it seemed related to the coronavirus topic that we are talking about. I will read the question. IDK, how many other folks are doing this? But my work just pulled the trigger on doing work from home for the rest of the month because coronavirus, no cases, just precaution because where they live is a whole mess in that regard. Any advice on 1, staying productive when you're not used to working from home? 2, not letting the stressy, depressy, or anxiety get to you. I wanted to obviously talk about, I think that working home, I just wanted to side note, say that something that occurred to me about this that I think is interesting is just about the shape of our world and things to consider is that, I've seen a lot of people from the, I guess, I don't know what the correct term is, disabled community or under, you know, I don't know, but like that people have been fighting for like the ability to work from home and being like, hey, we can do these jobs. Just we don't have to come to an office if you're disabled in some way, mentally or physically or whatever, for a while. And people are like, no, you have to come to the office. And how funny it is that as soon as this coronavirus works. So people are saying it's like a little bit of a revealing of like kind of ableist sort of standards and practices that we have that, like, as soon as there's this like virus thing, people are like, okay, well, I'll just work from home. No big deal.
Yeah.
Or if you want to get more political about it, that it's like maybe an aspect of capitalism wanting to rule your life. We got to be able to watch you and police you. And it's the only way you had to come to our office. But anyway, what do you think about that? Like, I do actually, some of this would be helpful for me because I'm totally freelance and I often have difficulty with both of these issues of being isolated when I work, like with focus and stuff like that, and like just being doing work, but also being isolated. Like, you know, one thing I envy about people who do go to an office is that they see people every day, you know, is that they go and interact with human beings and they don't get stuck in their office behind their screens, home alone in their house where maybe they don't shower for a few days, you know?
Yeah, totally. So, I can relate to this because, you know, when you're in graduate school, especially when you're like writing your dissertation, you know, people just kind of like disappear into the, like, you know, into your cave, your dissertation cave. I mean, look, I think there's you know, lots of folks have weighed in on this. I would say, unfortunately, kind of the common sage advice is probably the best, which is you have to make a routine for yourself.
Yeah.
And that can look a lot of different ways. I know, I forget the name of this technique, but you were mentioning that Ali does this.
The Pomodoro method.
Yeah, the Pomodoro method.
For people who are interested in that, I do find that helps her, and it helps me when I kind of like play along and follow it when she's doing it. You set a timer that's basically like, I don't know the exact time. I think it's like 30 minutes of work and then 5 minutes of screw around, like, and you can set the time to whatever you want. Maybe it's 45 minutes, 15 minutes, I think. But the idea being to keep yourself focused on trying to complete tasks, that if you know you want to scroll online or something distracts you, like, go on and look that thing up or respond to that text, whatever, you just tell yourself, oh, don't do it now. This is work. You're going to be able to do that in 20 minutes. Like, you can do whatever you want.
Right. So, yeah, exactly. So I think whether it's that or having another kind of routine, I find that, and I think that, again, the evidence would support having a written down schedule can be helpful. I also find, just for me personally, that if I go into so now I work in an office, but it's my office, you know, like nobody's in there, so it can still feel pretty isolating. But if I start by kind of like, well, I'm gonna like read some New York Times articles and like go on Twitter and blah, 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 I'll like, if I try to like ease into it, that's a disaster, you know, then I just keep on fucking doing that.
Yeah.
So what I find to be most helpful for me is like, I'll just go in, reply to the emails I need to reply to, and then work on something that's work, but that I like. So for me, like I'm running some analyses right now for a new manuscript and I just like that. So I'll just start working on those analyses. And
yeah. So prioritize things that you are actually attracted to working on.
I find that to be easier. Yeah. Other people are like, I'm going to go in and like hit the hardest thing I have to do.
Yeah.
You know,
I used to say, and it doesn't really work for me, but I used to say like, when we have like an impossible, basically I saw this, there's this, you know, there's like an old phrase that's like, how do you eat an elephant? Like one bite at a time or something. I don't know. Yeah. I just, it's a stupid aphorism. Yeah. So I always liked that. I was like, just a way to like, you know, one step at a time. It's the same thing, right? It's just this, you know, visual. But then I saw this video on like a National Geographic type thing, you know, of like a hyena going up to like eat a dead elephant carcass. But the elephant skin is like too tough to eat it. So they're like, how's the hyena going to do this? And then they'll be like, they find the softest part or something like that. And they start eating the butthole of the elephant. And like hyena just goes in through the ass. And I was like, that's a good addition to the metaphor. Like when you have a huge task to complete, when you have to eat an elephant, what do? Just one bite at a time, starting with the shittiest part, you know?
Yeah.
And, sometimes that does help. Sometimes it does actually help me to be like, let's just go get the tedious thing you're afraid of. Just attack that part first. But the other answer, the other way you could read that metaphor is going through the easiest point of entry first, which is pick something.
Yeah, I think the right answer, as with like so much of this stuff, is what's most effective for you. So, you know, I would try a couple different ways, but, you know, you have to, I would just say having some kind of written plan that you follow,
yeah,
schedule is critical. I mean, I'm like the, you know, that comes not naturally to me at all. Like I wasted so much time rebelling against structure, but yeah. I really need it. It's so helpful for me. And so if you're at all like that, I think having some kind of structure is helpful. The other yeah. thing I would say is like, I just go to the gym. I try to do yeah. it in the middle of the day if I can.
In the middle of the day?
I try to, yeah. I mean, sometimes I just can't because I'm working on something or I have meetings, whatever. But I try to break up the day with the gym because I just feel like recharged cognitively and physically. So if I notice I'm just getting kind of unproductive, if I just go to the gym and come back, that helps me to be more productive. So it can be hard to do that when you're in an office, but if you're working from home, you know, that could be something to try.
Yeah, totally. All right, cool. All right, the next questions I want to get into are both ADD-related stuff, I think. So we had one in the chat that I'm going to read and kind of pair up these questions. Does ADHD medication help with emotional flooding and or the depression that often accompanies ADHD? That's from Sweet Nothing. Thank you. And the other question I got was, I fixate on stuff and spiral. Their significant other, I believe, thinks I have OCD, but I don't want to be stereotyped by a syndrome nor dependent on a medication. Other people have thought I was ADHD, but I just think I'm weird and spontaneous. Shrugs. So doing a little bit of ADHD questions. I would just say anecdotally, I've been taking medication for ADHD. I don't know. Both of these questions speak to me a lot. I felt the diagnosis that I got 2 years ago as ADHD and then trying a little medication for it really changed my life and my experience of my life, I think. So the two questions here, broadly speaking, I think have to do with will medication treat the things that you don't – basically, the two things. One, the common, I think, misperception about what ADHD is, which is saying like, you know, I just think I'm weird and spontaneous, and so – but other people maybe think I have ADHD. And just saying like, you know, you might have no – and correct me on any of this. I'm going to throw to you. I just thought I'd talk about – since I had it for a little bit. That like yeah. A lot of adults who have adult ADHD won't even exhibit outward, they call it outward hyperactivity or something like that, external hyperactivity, something like that. They have an internal internal hyperarousal was the phrase that I saw. So you just have thoughts that are racing and I think that, my experience, circular and like constant. And that's where some of the emotional flooding stuff comes from. And the depression symptoms, I believe, they come from rejection sensitivity dysphoria. That's one of the things that something will happen that triggers you. You will perceive a rejection or a failure or something like that, so which is sort of a rejection of yourself. And then you'll just ruminate and spin about it in your head. And you'll have so much experience that outwardly you might not even be showing. And that certainly I have some of that external hyperarousal, like a typical sort of image of a 12-year-old boy, you know, who's all over the place, ADHD kind of thing. That happens to me sometimes for sure, where weird and spontaneous seem to be part of it. But sometimes when I think I'm suffering from it the most, I'm actually very quiet. I'm very isolated. It's just like internally I'm going crazy. So I fully understand also the fear of like getting a diagnosis. I didn't do it till I was 32. I'm 34 now. Because I knew my dad had been diagnosed with it, and I felt with that and some other diagnoses he had, I just felt like he relied too much on medication and it changed him and he didn't do much work, you know, to try to work on himself, and that freaked me out. And I just also didn't like the idea of having a label of saying like, oh, this is going to be me now. And what if I, yeah. are there going to be jobs that I try to apply for that says on my resume somewhere like, oh, he's got depression and he's got ADHD, he's got a mental illness or something like that. You know, I was just so freaked out by that possibility. So I understand the hesitation. I know I'm kind of rambling about this, but the two things I will say is one, I'm so glad that I did get this diagnosis, because when I did, there's so much literature. It's such a relief. This is also what led me to go to a psychiatrist in the first place, because I had found some articles online and been like, whoa, that's me, where it is such a relief when you realize the way you've been feeling that you think has to do with moral failures, that's sure. to do with like decision making problems. Yeah, that you know, cultural mores, that you are just lazy or something like that, or ignorant of people's needs, or just uncaring and selfish. And when you realize some of these behavioral issues have nothing to do with those sort of moral judgments, they have to do with, you know, brain patterning that you have, and that they are recorded patterns to this. There's treatments for it. There's so many other people out there who have what you have. It's a great relief. And to realize that there are some, you know, strategies that have already been established to work with it. And then I will say, lastly, my experience is that my medication, which I just take a little bit of Adderall, it's a fairly low dose. Yeah, definitely helped with those symptoms that you don't, because I think people think of Adderall as a performance enhancing drug for focus or something like that, a fun sort of brain cocaine. And I will say, as somebody who has ADHD, that if you really do have it and it serves your brain the way it's meant to, it's sort of calming. It does help with focus. And I have found it definitely helps with those emotional flooding and depression sort of symptoms, these more emotional aspects of ADHD, which I really didn't necessarily expect it to. But I noticed in the past, in my relationship even, sometimes if I was inconsistent with the medication, we would start like fighting in the same ways, like my rejection sensitivity would be crazier, or like I would do the same emotional flooding. And it would be like, have you been taking your medication? And I'd realize like, oh man, I really haven't. And some of these like old bad patterns would behavior would come up. Things that are in me, things that have to do with my responses and my overreaction to things. And again, emotional flooding and things that it really did regulate those things as well. So that was a long thing, but those are my experiences anecdotally with ADHD. Please, doctor, what do you think?
Well, so let me first just say that I'm not a psychiatrist, and only medical doctors are able to prescribe psychiatric medication. Right. So if people want to know more about psychiatric medication, they really should talk to a psychiatrist. Yes. That's my disclaimer.
I want to ask you really quick, an interesting parallel I just thought, though. Psychology, you were just saying, you said earlier about the scheduling thing, that like what should always be the, you said something like, what should always be the thing is, does it work for you?
Yeah. So that's exactly. So let me, that's a really critical point when it comes to the kind of landscape of diagnosis as well. So let me just kind of zoom out a little bit. I'm really glad that you kind of highlighted your experience where diagnosis was helpful, because it helped you to frame your experiences.
Yeah.
And that's what diagnosis is. Diagnosis is not meant to be a label or some denigration of your personality or anything like that. The only reason, when it comes to mental health, the diagnosis is useful is if it points to treatment that's effective. That's why we use a diagnosis, because different diagnoses indicate different treatments to improve your symptoms. Yeah. That's the point. So to the extent that a diagnosis is useful in pointing you towards a particular treatment, that's why it's effective. For example, we know that there are certain therapeutic techniques and medications that are effective for treating symptoms of depression. So if we diagnose you with symptoms of depression, we know, hey, we should probably look at some of these treatments, because the evidence shows that that's effective. Whereas if you're diagnosed with something like schizophrenia, there are other treatments and medications that have been demonstrated to be effective for that particular disorder. So we'd want to point you in that direction. So diagnosis is a navigational tool. It's a tool for navigating you towards effective treatments. That's it. That's a utility. Okay. So when it comes to ADHD, the primary treatment has typically been stimulant medication. And stimulant medication has been shown to be very effective. Okay. Also, stimulant medication can be effective for people who don't have ADHD. So, you know, if I take stimulant medication, which I've done on occasion, like when I was having to finish my dissertation, I took a little stimulant medication. I do not have ADHD, but that allowed me to sit down and work for like 5 hours uninterrupted.
Yeah. You
know? So I think that is the nature of stimulant medication. Mm. Its performance in the brain is also effective for people without ADHD.
What's interesting about that to me is that, like you're like, for 5 hours at a time, is like my baseline experience is one of inability to work at all or ability to sit and work for 12 hours at a time. Like, no, like not even really joking. Like, I'm like, sure. 5 hours, that's it. Like when I do work sprints, they go crazy. There's like a few, and I this was a big thing for me in understanding ADHD as well. that it isn't just weird and spontaneous. It's not just scattered focus. It should be understood as a focus regulation issue. It's not that you can't focus. It's sometimes you, which is interesting because I always feel like the effect that a stimulant medication has on a neurotypical brain, I feel like ends up being sort of similar to what it's like to just have an ADHD brain if you don't have it. Like that sometimes you'll, like I kind of feel like I'm on cocaine all the time. And sometimes it's very scattered and crazy, and sometimes it's very focused, and that there's something about taking an actual medication that if you have that does the opposite. And I could go into, I've tried to explain my layman understanding in the past, but we don't need to go down that road right now. But I just think that's interesting to hear that your experience doing it, I don't know, that it gives you some of, I guess one of the reasons I bring this up is I'm always trying to make people understand, like, these diagnoses don't have to be scary. They really are, like you just said, a tool to understanding your brain, and that there are actually some great benefits, I think, to some of the atypical brain shapes out there. And that with ADHD, you are also given a few superpowers. It's like, I always feel like it's like, if you were like in a role playing game and you're like doing your character creation screen, that like if you picked ADHD as a trait, it would be like you get plus, you'd have like a random generator that says like some days you get bonuses to studying and focus, and some days you're gonna have, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So right. I mean, I think, you know, we should to reiterate. I think we should be looking at these things, diagnoses and treatments, as tools to help you be effective and to help you be happier.
Yes.
That's really the purpose. And so, you know, nobody has been able to articulate what a normal brain looks like in any kind of quantitative sense at all. How much of a particular neurotransmitter, when, what types of, I mean, we can look at brains and say, well, this is a really abnormal brain. There's, you know, like a reduction in gray matter. There's physiological damage to one of the hemispheres. We can do that stuff. But nobody's been able to say like, oh, well, this is a totally normal functional brain based on these parameters. I mean, that's definitely not the case. Yeah. So I would get less worried about normal and not normal and more focused on if I'm having symptoms or issues that bother me and I'm having a really hard time managing them to be effective and happy, is there a professional I can go to talk to who can introduce me to a suite of tools, which will include potentially diagnoses and treatment options? And then why don't I can try some of those treatment options to see which are effective. So stimulant medication can be very effective. Also, meditation, there are studies that show that meditation, because it helps with attention management and attention control, can be a very effective tool for ADHD too. So if people are reluctant to, you know, use any type of medication, I think you should examine that reluctance with a professional. But there are other strategies that the evidence shows to be effective. So diagnosis is not telling you what type of person you are. It's when it comes to mental health, it's really just asking if a set of symptoms or descriptions of behaviors and feelings approximate what you're going through. And if they do approximate what you're going through, it helps us to point to a suite of tools that have been shown to be more effective in ameliorating those symptoms. That's really it. So again, you know, I would really encourage people to make an appointment, if you're able to, if you have insurance, or if you can make an appointment with a professional. I would do that. And it doesn't have to be a psychiatrist. You can, if you don't want to, you know, people use the tools that they're trained in. And so this is not always the case. Like, I've known many psychiatrists whose goal was to like reduce people's medications. But if you don't want to go right away to somebody who you think might give you a prescription for medication, talk to a licensed clinical social worker, talk to a psychologist, talk to a marriage and family therapist, and see what approaches they suggest.
Yeah. And that's a nice little plug for our, I made a brand new overlay for the channel today. There are some resources we put at the bottom of the screen that Dr. Nick picked for us, that if you need some extra help, there's obviously some more crisis-y lines there, but also the NAMI and the DBT websites on there are good resources for finding some of this stuff. I know that navigating my, I have insurance that's not the greatest insurance in the world. It's through Covered California. And it is very hard to navigate the, it's actually miserable. And I go to somebody outside of my insurance to that I was referred to from, I will just briefly give a mini history of like mental health support I've gotten in the past, because I've never had a lot of extra money. And so what I have done is, the first places I went for therapy were all sliding scale community access places. So I went to the Maple Center. If you're in LA, I went to the Maple Center, and then I went to the Southern California Counseling Center a couple years later. They're wonderful resources. I will say, especially at the second one, at Southern California Counseling Center, usually there's a wait. Usually it's like a $50 intake. So you got to save that $50 and go pay for that, where they do the intake of they get you in your system and talk to you and see if you're a fit, see if there's something they can help you with. And I'm sure there will be. If you showed up there, there will be probably a reason that they'll help you. And then usually there's a wait. In my case, at this, like the wait can be a couple weeks or, you know, before they can put you someone, because again, these are sliding scale resources. So, like anything that's trying to help the community, usually they're a little inundated and doing their best. But, I will say the second place I went to, the Southern California Counseling Center, when I wound up there, and did my intake, I was in a really bad place. I don't think I realized how bad I was till I got there. I was fucking very scared in the sitting room there. It was, I felt like a dog at the vet, I said. I just felt like crying for no reason, like looking around everywhere and just being like, what the fuck, you know, what am I doing here? And I was apparently worse than I even could feel. They were like, we're going to get you in here as soon as possible. We can tell you're in some crisis. And I was like, okay, you know, so they got me in that week. They gave me some phone numbers, like similar to the ones on the screen, in case things got worse before then. And then I started going, and I think it was $30, $25 or $30 a session. Was my, like, was it worked out to like my, you know, which I know even just an extra $25 or $30 can be difficult, but, you know, eat some canned fish for a few days and don't buy lunch and you can do it. So it's a pretty wonderful resource. So I started there, and then years later, when I decided to try to see a psychiatrist, I had a good relationship with my therapist at the counseling center, and she had left to do her own private practice as a psychologist therapist. I reached out to her, and she gave me a referral to a psychiatrist, and I ended up going to that psychiatrist for the intake and medication and that kind of a thing. All outside of my resources, she has been wonderful in being like helpful about the rates. Like, I basically pay her real rates when I can afford them. And when I can't, she lets me pay a reduced rate. I think a lot of people in this profession really do want to help people. And so there are people to look that will help. When I tried to go through my own system, which would be a cheaper cost, it was a nightmare. It was like, they make it seem easy, and there's some teledoc resources that are kind of neat or whatever, but in a lot of the places on my HMO wouldn't see me if I didn't have a diagnosis already. People would be like, we'll see you and fill your prescriptions, but like they wouldn't do intake meetings, or it was very strange and very difficult. So yeah. I just want to say that I commiserate with anybody who's having those issues. I know it can be expensive and difficult, but it has really changed. I mean, I could go as far as saying it saved my life. It's absolutely changed my life in a positive way. So I implore you, look for those resources that are community accessible. Those sort of sliding scale places to start are great.
I think it's so valuable for people to hear that story. And let me just... I think like one, you know, sort of the subtext to your story there is that this, even, you know, it's very rarely the case that you're going to have a immediate relief. Like it's a process. It's a long process, and we should accept in advance that it is going to be a long process. Like any kind of, like any domain of health, it's going to be a long and ongoing management process. And the better you kind of get control of it and start managing it, the easier it is to manage over time. Like diabetes, for example, getting it under control in the beginning is really difficult and, you know, takes a lot of investment and effort. And then managing it over time tends to be easier once you're in a good system of care with people who know you. And it's the same for mental health. You know, that being said, if you are, we have some numbers on the bottom. If people are feeling like in acute crisis, they're feeling like they might kill themselves, or they might, they're in a an untenable situation. If you go through a psychiatric emergency room, you tend to get plugged into care fast, but it's a very unpleasant experience. So I wouldn't, you know, recommend that unless people feel as if they really cannot keep themselves safe.
That's like the 5150 type of resources, like emergency.
Yeah, I mean, so 5150 is in California is involuntary hold.
Uh-huh.
So if you self-refer to a psych ER and you meet the criteria for admittance, you won't be placed on a 5150 because you're there voluntarily.
Okay.
But similarly, yeah, like if you were, you know, it's similar, right, where you're then at the psych ER and you get kind of referred to your mental health services through their Office of Discharge Planning and all that stuff.
You worked
that's a great way to go,
yeah,
unless you're in an emergency.
You worked at some of those like public resources, right, in LA for a while.
Sorry?
You worked at some of those public resources.
Yeah, I worked for LA County Department of Mental Health. Yeah. So, yeah. Which, you know, the clinic where I worked, I think, is excellent. It was Harbor UCLA. I mean, I really think it's top notch. It kind of depends, you know, where they're different. There are like 8 service areas in LA County. So there are a lot of different clinics, but,
Do you recommend those, or you're saying those are ones to like, if in an extreme circumstance, use them, but if you feel.
I do recommend the public mental health clinics in LA.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that's a good resource, but they don't meet, not everyone can be seen there, you know?
Yes.
Again, that kind of middle tier problem where if you like make enough money that you can't receive public benefits, it's actually quite expensive to go there. But the psychiatric emergency room is like so I worked at an outpatient clinic, but the psych ER is like a residential, they have beds, you know, where you would stay overnight.
Yeah.
And that people, it really is if you're feeling like you might kill yourself or you or someone you know is having such an acute mental health crisis that they really just can't take care of themselves. Like they're having, you know, florid delusions or hallucinations or something like that.
A side note to this question came in the chat from IndigiQueer93 or comment question, but I think it's important because it's related to this whole thing of diagnosis and seeking help. Understanding the function of a diagnosis, how do we move forward with the normalizing such labels in a healthy way? Maybe for those who don't have the label, the diagnosis, versus those who do. So I speaking to this issue of we may understand, and I would say it seems to me that that is part of the start. I still have to deal with my own internalized stigma. I mean, part of the reason I started the podcast was I think that the destigmatizing of mental health is something that's gotten great in the public discourse, you know, telling people to seek mental health and that there's no shame in it and blah, blah, I think is so true. We just tend to feel that way for other people, and that turning the lens on ourselves and being like, what do I, you know, I'm very woo woo and supportive and kind. And I'm like, oh, great, you're getting help to everybody else. But do I really feel that way? Am I still afraid of being labeled with this thing? And so I don't know, I would think part of it would be processing our own judgments and you know, preconceived notions about these, you know, if you find out that somebody is ADHD or depressed or BPD even or something, that you don't just go like, oh, they're crazy, you know?
I mean, it's, you know what, it's really tricky, and nobody has there are like very, very few well-studied anti-stigma interventions, but one of the things that seems to be helpful is when people in leadership positions disclose and contribute to a culture that's accepting. So, you know, people who are in power positions in society, like our kind of wealthy, older white men, I think those people need to be disclosing, you know?
Yeah.
Those people need to be contributing to a culture of acceptance and destigmatization, because, you know, it's helpful when people who are kind of already in precarious social positions do that. Like, that's really helpful and important, but we need people who are at the top of the hierarchy to be doing this also, you know?
That makes sense. That makes sense. I think otherwise it's like just on us to like build our new world as we keep going.
Yeah. The other thing I would say is that, you know, I do think that we need to have a balance of, and I really mean a balance of acceptance and kind of holding for ourselves and for others who have these problems, you know, when we have them, because, you know, it's like 1 in 5 or more. I think it's 1 in 3 at some point in their life is going to have some of these problems. Okay. It's a lot of fucking people. And I'm guessing it's more, you know, so it's just very common. At the same time, holding is not enough. I do think it's incumbent on you to seek treatment, whatever that looks like, you know, whether it's professional treatment, if you have access to those resources, or self-help tools. It's not enough to say, this is my problem and everyone needs to like accept where I am right now. That's one part of it. But the other piece is you got to work on being happier and getting better. And I don't want people to mishear me and say it's your fault and you need to do everything. I'm not saying that. It's both of those things together at the same time. It's a dialectic of acceptance internally and asking for acceptance from other people. You've got to do that. But it's also on working to make the changes. It's both acceptance and change at the same time. And they're like a yin yang circle, you know, like you can't really make change without first having acceptance, but acceptance is enough without also working to make change. So that's a dialectic.
I think that's so important to mention, because I do feel like there's a very confusing, one thing that really gets my goat when I see it is like, as somebody who is like, okay, how can I say this? I don't know. I'll just say it and say it wrong or whatever I'm going to say. I do think there's a bit of a thing in the culture right now of some people observe, especially people in positions of privilege observe, they seem to observe, whether or not it's real, but they get the message that there's a kind of social currency to having anything that could be victim-y, that there's that if you could say, how dare you, I have this thing, that there's some sort of identity power, like there's a social currency that comes with that. And nothing makes me more bothered than people who use a diagnosis or you know, like that they have some sort of mental state as an excuse without doing any work. And I say that not because I'm like pissed that they're getting some kind of social currency out of saying they're depressed. It's because having depression, having ADHD fucking sucks sometimes. Like, as much as I am like, I do like to see it as a superpower. I do like to make it positive for myself. It doesn't feel good to have depression. It doesn't feel good to have a brain and work and engagement habits that really don't fit a lot with the standard economy and social structure that we have. It's very difficult. And it also feels really bad when those behaviors, the negative aspects of them, hurt your relationships, hurt your loved ones, and make your life difficult in that way. And so when I see people who use a diagnosis or use a phrase about their condition, whatever, without evidently trying to work on it, it really bothers me, because I'm like, oof, I don't know. There's something about it that's just like, you can't just say, hey, I have BPD, or like, hey, I don't get on me, I have depression. There's a fine line between like making your space for yourself and, like you said, this acceptance and looking for a destigmatization from your community and your world. Yeah. And like, are you doing anything to try to fix it for yourself, you know?
Well, right. I mean, so this is a thing, like my kind of holy grail for all of this stuff is effectiveness. And if it was effective to ask everyone else around you to just accommodate you, then I would say, sure, why not do that? If that's working, do that.
I think that's part of the problem, is for some people, it's effective that you get to be like, oh, I get to be in this community. I'm a special citizen now. You know what I mean?
Right. So what I would say is that it can be effective in the short term. In the short term, which I think why people get kind of addicted to this tool, it can be very effective in the short term, because I think most people, and maybe it's just most people I know being in this kind of specialized world, when they hear someone is going through something, they want to accommodate. Oh, okay, I get it. I will accommodate. But, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 months down the road, that strategy ceases to be effective. And what will happen is typically you burn bridges, you burn people out in your social network, you lose that support, and the symptoms get worse. I mean, I've just seen that pattern happen many, many times. And so, as with most things, you know, short-term effective coping strategies are typically not the same as long-term effective coping strategies.
Yeah.
And that's why we need to have that dialectic.
Yeah. I think two people in the chat said great things. Like taking responsibility of the diagnosis and not taking the blame of it is my takeaway. Someone else said your mental illness is not your fault, but it is your responsibility. And I'm like, both of those feel spot on.
Exactly. One of the assumptions in DBT, this dialectical behavior therapy, is that you almost certainly did not cause all of your problems.
Right.
And you will be the one who has to fix them. You know, those things are both true at the same time. It's definitely not you. All the shit that you're going through is definitely not all your fault.
Right.
But you are going to have to fix it.
Yes. That to me, I love that, because something I struggle with, and I know I've said this a million times, but I'll keep saying it because it's always the line I'm trying to walk here and trying to find my way through for myself and for the things I say and put out with this show. It's like, I don't want to disempower. Like, I first of all want to create a space of validation, acceptance, community, and solidarity, saying like, your problems are real. Like, it's not just something in your head. It's not just toughen up. It's a physical issue that you're experiencing. And even if it's not physical, it's physical. Like, traumas have real effects on people. This is real. What you're going through is real.
Yeah.
At the same time, I want to make sure for myself that I don't get so down the path of this is real that I disempower myself from healing myself, that I remove my own agency to change my behaviors to work at it, you know?
Exactly, because understanding is not the end point. It is the beginning point.
Yes.
So you need to have some kind of understanding, and you need to have some kind of acceptance and self-validation, and hopefully some from the community as a, you know, your network as a starting point. But that's your foundation. You know, that's not the end. From there, it becomes, how do I employ strategies and intervention to get myself to the place where I want to be, where I'm more effective in my life and happier and meeting my goals and, you know, living consistent with values. That's the next step. And that's like really hard. It takes a lot of work.
And I got to say also, I think if you have people who really love you in your community, who know you and love you for real, sometimes I'm great. Like, I think of it almost like if you've ever been in a sort of codependency relationship, real dramatic, real toxic. We've all been in this when we're younger. And eventually your friends stop giving a fuck. Like the first times they're like, they listen to you and they're there as you go on and on for hours about like, and then I had to respond to the text because of this, you know, or whatever, like just saying nonsense. And then like, eventually they'll stop. Eventually you break up, you get that, they cradle you, they're with you. Oh God, they hate the person for you, whatever. But eventually, if you get back together, this thing happens, people get burned out and they start to like not be, they're like, oh really? Did that happen again? Did they do literally the same? Oh, that's weird. Crazy. Whoa. I used to do it with one of my friends. I'd be like, what? There must be some misunderstanding. They sound like they probably grew up. Anyway, I say all that to say that I think if someone really loves you, their response is one of going like, all right, well, I'm not going to keep enabling this. And sometimes our own mental illnesses, I really think a lot of times it's felt to me like I have a codependent relationship with myself. Like, and if I, my
Which
friends,
probably you do. Probably all do.
But that this feeling of like, if people really love me, which some people very close to me, I know really love me and give a shit, they don't put up with it forever. They call me out. They go, hey, you're doing the same thing. You're falling back into habits that seem to be going on in times that you said you felt really bad or you felt really like you were numbing out or whatever was going on. And they don't let you just keep fucking going. And sometimes that can feel bad, especially if you have rejected. You can feel like, oh, you hate me, I'm a fuck up, blah, blah. But if somebody really loves you and they know you, I think that will happen sometimes, and it can be quite nice.
For sure.
Okay, I have one last question, and it's a long question, but I meant to get to it earlier, but this has been kind of a lively talk, and so perhaps we'll go a little over with it, but let's just, I want to get into this one because this is the one I really wanted to ask. It's a big one. Yeah. And I think it'll relate to some of the things we've talked about already. this person said, they were complimenting the podcast and saying some of the thoughts feel like their thoughts, and it's nice to know they're not alone in that. And then continue. I feel alone in my mental illness lately. I suffer from derealization, depression, ADD, which are possibly all symptoms of complex PTSD. I'm not medicated. I've only had bad experiences with meds, and with my dissociation issues, it can get pretty weird. I would love to hear you guys talk about derealization and ways to cope with that. With all of that, existence feels really heavy. I do a lot of staying home and doing homework, ignoring people who care about me and letting them know I care, but I can't be consistent for anyone, not even myself. I'm in love with someone who's willing to only see me about once a month when I'm having a good weekend. I want to be better. I want to be social, but every cell in my body and mind is working against me. If you guys suggest revisiting medication, what are the best questions to ask so they don't throw a high dose of I can't feel anymore at me? So yeah. I'd love to hear about tools to help cope with dissociative disorders, being social when it's scary to leave the house and you feel like a loser bummer and that nothing is real anyway, so it extra doesn't matter. I'm laughing because I relate to that. And do meds help you because the productive, reliable person that you wish to be in the world? And then they said, sorry if that was way too much, LOL. I was like, hey, we're all too much. That's not too much. That sounds like a yeah, real question.
Great. So it's a great question. So first, I just want to say to this person, if you have had traumatic experiences, please go and talk to a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a licensed clinical social worker. Make the appointment. And if you want to avoid talking about medication right away, go see a psychologist or a licensed clinical social worker.
Can I ask, are there any sort of teledoc, like remote resources for that? Because I don't know. I know if I live in a big city, usually I can find something.
Yeah. I mean, there's this proliferation of apps.
That's true.
To be honest, the outcomes for telehealth seem to be pretty good. This person though, because this seems to be a fairly complex case, my recommendation would be, if possible, for them to make an intake appointment face-to-face.
Got it.
And to not give up if they don't like the first person they see.
Right.
So here's the thing. Depersonalization, derealization, the experience that, you know, your thoughts aren't real or that the world around you is not real, that you're disconnected from your sensory experience. There are some strategies for those, for working on that. And it's things like grounding in the five senses, okay? It's narrating to yourself what you're seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, feeling in the present moment. So I'm in my chair. I put my hands on the chair. I'm telling myself what the wood grain feels like beneath my fingers, you know, what my body, back, and butt feel like in my seat, what I'm seeing in front of me. Those are some techniques. But here's the thing. If you're experiencing trauma symptoms, derealization, depersonalization can be symptoms of trauma, and it's kind of a sort of like a little bit of a the mind's way of trying to insulate you from having trauma reminders, and it's just kind of gone a little bit too far. So what you don't want to do is start taking away these protective strategies for trauma before you replace them with something else that's more effective. And it's just much healthier to do that with a professional. We have very good treatments for PTSD, very good. So it's treatable. You know, things like prolonged exposure, cognitive processing therapy, EMDR, these are gold standard evidence-based trauma treatments. And often you don't use medication. Mm. Now, sometimes medication can be effective for treating trauma. I think in the VA, that's typically first line. I don't love that. And there's a lot of research we could go into to talk about why. But the gold standard trauma treatments are therapeutic treatments. Okay. So I wouldn't, you know, and if you tell somebody, look, I don't want to get on medication right away, that's fine. They won't put you on.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
But you really do need to make that appointment. And when you work on those trauma symptoms, you know, through one of those interventions, what you start to do is gain some control over the trauma memories and reminders. They start to go from experiences that make your body feel as if they're happening now, which is one of the kind of hallmarks of trauma memory. They're stored in such a way that retrieval is not located in the present moment. They're the retrieval triggers the physiological symptoms that would be happening as if the experience was happening now.
Wow.
Instead of memory of the experience that's happening in the past. So, you know, going through those trauma treatments will help re-encode those memories in a way that don't trigger those symptoms. And when that starts to happen, the kind of derealization, depersonalization that insulates you from those symptoms, you won't need those because you'll have control over those memories. And you'll learn some physiological relaxation techniques like progressive muscle relaxation and deep breathing. You know, those are two techniques that I would suggest that you try. But yeah, I think it's critical to go and get that treatment. And again, it doesn't need to start with medication. And actually, I would imagine that if you see someone good, they won't immediately start you with medication. You know, some of the other things in terms of like isolating at home, I mean, this is consistent with, avoidance behaviors associated with trauma. So, you know, I think,
yeah,
when it's a complex case like this, I really think you should see a professional.
Yeah, that can be so helpful. The all the things you described, I mean, I learned only very basics, like tapping, some small EMDR things. Then the thing you said about the five senses centering thing, I had a therapist run me through that, which was like both very helpful things. Because I remember, I've said this on the podcast before, but it was a moment for me that I always think about was my going to my, because I will say this about getting therapy as well. You said earlier something about like that these things take time, that you have to, you know, keep working at it. And that's definitely true. I remember there are times when I'd show up for my, you know, I'd show up for my appointment and be like, what the fuck am I doing here? Or I'd leave the appointment and be like, what did I even do today? What was that, you know? And just setting those 50 minutes a week, I think, were important almost in like a symbolic way, saying like, I'm dedicating this time to try to work on myself. And then leaving and being like, through the week, trying to work on myself. But something sometimes just making the space. And I remember one of the sessions I said, my therapist,
you know,
say that again.
As sometimes you have a bad workout, but still good that you work.
Exactly. And I remember one time a therapist just said something like, they just said like, how you feeling? Like, you know, offhand, like you would just say, how you feeling? You know? And I took it like very literally and realized like I couldn't feel my body. Like I felt like, I don't know. I took an inventory and I was like, and they ran me through that thing of like this thing of, you know, feeling the pressure of the chair pushing into your butt and, you know, your feet sinking on the floor and the gravity pulling on you. And, you know, literally just going through this inventory of like, what are you literally feeling?
Yeah.
Which then helped me sort of, you know, come back to the now, come back to the present moment, get into my body, get into my actual emotional feelings. Then I could start to talk about like identifying some thoughts I was having and feelings that I was having more ephemerally than just the somatic one. So anyway, that sounds like really good advice. I'd also say in terms of like personally overcoming the trap of the house, or rather like your brain, when your brain is doing like jail brain, when it's like you just can't do anything. For me, I don't know, it doesn't always work, you know? I mean, nothing always works, but just little strategies that, if I don't know, making tiny, tiny goals. Like one thing I always thought about was when I was younger, swimming in the summer or something like that, there was this lake that was, I would always think like the lake was so cold, Lake Michigan, when we go visit my family. And I was like, I convinced myself that I didn't have to think about jumping in the water. I just had to think about jumping off the dock, and not even jumping off the dock, but just like jumping, like being near the edge and then jumping. And if I just made my feet jump, then gravity would take over. Like the rest of it would just do it. Then you'd be in the water. Yeah. Then you'd be dealing with it. If I'm thinking I'm going to put myself in this cold water, that's really scary. That's really painful. That's really difficult. Like I can't do it. But if I thought like I need to fire my Achilles tendons so that I move up and forward a little bit, then everything else just that was something I could get myself to do. So sometimes if I can't get out of bed, it's because I can't think about the whole life and world and day, and I, you know, it's too, but I can maybe think about like put one foot on the floor and then I would be, and literally I'll walk myself through these tiny little victories. Like little things to do. I can't think. I got to do the dishes, but I might be able to think, turn the faucet on. And you know, taking it one, and then eventually sometimes a little snowball will start and you'll be doing the thing.
So this is like, that is a great technique. And what that's called in like trauma treatment is to make an exposure hierarchy, where the idea, so you, that just intuitive strategy that you used is like right on the fucking money. So like what we do in a lot of trauma treatments is you make an exposure hierarchy. Maybe the idea of going out in broad daylight to a crowded place to have lunch with your friends seems terrifying, but maybe having a coffee in the morning when it's not that crowded at a place near your house seems less terrifying. And you could actually rate those things with a number. And I would pick the things that are a little bit challenging, like 20 out of 100, but not 80 out of 100 right away, because you want to scaffold up and have success experiences. So maybe start with scheduling lunch with a trusted friend at a place that's not that crowded, and just know that you are not going to feel like doing that, and your brain's going to supply you with an infinite number of excuses why you shouldn't. And you just have to use some of these strategies to try to get yourself to go. But pick something that you rate your chance of success as 80%. Mm. Or don't pick something that you rate your chance of success as like, oh, fuck, I don't know, 10%. Don't do that.
Okay, that's great. Set yourself up to win, you know? Okay, well, let's wrap up. I just want to, there's a couple little questions Sweet Nothing asked that I wanted to queue up for you. One was Sweet Nothing, one was Sunless Crowd, but just for you, whatever. One of them was, can you recommend any further reading or meditation resource guides that you could, like, they said, cool to hear the promotion of meditation. Any studies you would suggest for further reading or meditation resources guides you could suggest? That would be much appreciated.
Sure. So, okay. So there are well over 5,000 studies using mindfulness or mindfulness meditation techniques with adults. You got to kind of define it a little, narrow it a little bit in terms of what kind of outcomes you're interested in looking at. But a place to start is, it really depends on kind of what outcomes and what populations you're looking at. But I would just go to Google Scholar and whatever outcome or population you're interested in, just put that with meditation in Google Scholar. So for example, if you're interested in mindfulness and anxiety, just type those both into Google Scholar and you're going to get a bazillion hits. Okay. And you can read those abstracts all for free. But I would say like a good place to start is if you just want to put in mindfulness meta-analysis on Google Scholar, that will give you studies of studies. Which are kind of the gold standard evidence. So I would just start there. I have like 5 or 6 publications at this point using mindfulness as a predictor of mental health outcomes in military veterans. So if you want to read like my work, you can just Google Scholar my name with mindfulness and you'll get a couple of hits.
That's Nicholas Barr. Nicholas space Barr.
Yeah, if this person, though, if they just want to shoot me an email or send me like a direct message with a little more like narrowing of which population and which outcomes, I can, and if they're having trouble, I can like get them a full PDF for free because I can do that at the university.
Cool.
That's one.
Is your email listed somewhere or should they just write My Good Bad Brain?
They can do My Good Bad Brain. They can do Dr. Nicholas Barr at DR, Nicholas Barr at Gmail. That's fine.
There you go.
In terms of like books, if you want kind of a more theoretical underpinning, I recommend What the Buddha Taught by Walpola Rahula. That is a free PDF, What the Buddha Taught. It's a little bit more kind of like the Buddhist formulation. If you want kind of like a more kind of practical, like how to meditation sort of manual, I would start with one of the apps. I think they do a pretty, like Headspace, for example, I think does a pretty good job just giving you, you know, practical exercises you can try on your own. It's free. I don't have any affiliation with them at all. I just think that's like an easy one.
I don't either, but we're open to sponsorships.
Yeah, right. Yeah. They're also free. Like if you go to just YouTube and look up meditative stabilization. You'll get a bunch of exercises. But again, if you want what I can also do is I can put together like a little bit of a.
That sounds good. I think I was going to suggest after, but that, give me some resources. I'll put them on the Twitter and I'll put them on the Good Bad Brain Instagram page. We'll just put them somewhere that people can find them. Yeah, great. And then the last little question here somebody had was, and please email. Yes, we'll post that. But if you do want a direct thing, please email mygoodbadbrain@gmail.com or drnicholasbarr@gmail.com. And we'll get that for you. Last one here. We'll just maybe have a quick answer for it. Suggestions for finding, they said herbalist, but they wrote therapist then afterwards. I've been taking pine pollen tincture. Anyway, suggestions for finding a therapist who specializes in complex PTSD. I've been struggling to find the right fit.
Yeah. So the herbalist one, I'm afraid I can't help with, but the therapist one. Yeah. So if you go to, for example, prolonged exposure, which is the treatment that I'm most extensively trained in. If you go to I can't remember the website off the top of my head, but if you just Google prolonged exposure, Edna Foa, Foa, F-O-A, she has a website, and the people who have completed the prolonged exposure training are listed on her website, and they're searchable. So you can see people, for example, who are trained in that methodology. But yeah, rather than necessarily looking up people who are trained like in complex PTSD, I would be looking for people who are trained in evidence-based trauma interventions. And again, the big ones are prolonged exposure, cognitive processing therapy, EMDR. Personally, I think if you're a military veteran, it's a little bit different. I would email me directly. But for lay people who did not experience combat trauma, my personal recommendation, because I'm trained in it and I've seen it work, is prolonged exposure. Again, there are other things that work. It's just my personal recommendation. So I would suggest finding a therapist who's trained in prolonged exposure. Again, you can do that by going to the Edna Foa's prolonged exposure training website and looking up therapists who are trained in that methodology. I would also, you know, if you go through an insurance person, like for me, if I schedule therapy, I call my insurance company and then they schedule me with someone at the behavioral health provider here in Southern Nevada. And I would just ask them, you can call me back, but I need someone who's trained in this methodology.
I have put in the chat, I believe this is the site, med.upenn.edu/CTSA/find-PE-therapist.
Yeah.
That seems to be the correct. And they've got a listing of, looks like every state they've got, and internationally as well. So that's dope. All right, cool. Let's wrap it up. Do you want to add something to Don't Kill Yourself list real quick?
Well, I know I mentioned this last week, but yesterday I took like a hot bath with a little bit of tequila and continued reading my comic book, and I needed that. It was very relaxing.
Oh, tequila in the bath.
Yeah.
I've heard of shower beers, but bath tequila is like next.
Bath tequila. Yeah, exactly. I don't recommend a lot of tequila for dealing with problems, but it was just a little bit.
Yeah, no, of course. Spirits. I'm going to say I like love little journals. Just like is a little like moleskin thing.
Yeah.
Oh, I fucking love these things, dude. If I'm ever like, this one's made by someone called Fabriano. I don't know, but they got a little pack of these. You go to like a Blick or something, some art store, and they've got like just a selection of moleskins and little. Oh my God, I love a little notebook. This particular notebook I started to track everything I eat and then how I poop as well, you know.
Oh, nice.
Because I finally made a gastroenterologist appointment, which shall
end to end.
Yes. On the Fool's Day, April 1st. but I was like, I figured I'd start tracking now what I eat and how I poop. But it's just so nice. Oh, it just feels
And here's another, let me just say one other little thing here. Don't feel like you need to complete that thing or fill it all the way up. Fuck it. Write in as much as you want. And when you're ready for a new one, start the new one.
Yeah, absolutely. I get unfinished. I get new despite having unfinished journals. It's important. It's to start a new thing. Even just a composition notebook with the like weird black and white camo pattern, whatever they have on it. Ugh, terrific. All right. Thanks, guys. We ran a little bit over today, but this it sounds like the sound functioned. We segued in. We got great questions. Thank you guys for joining us. I'm going to attempt to play the theme music here to like get us out. And Dr. Nick, thank you again.
Great questions, really.
Yeah, great questions. Thank you for joining us. You guys are the best. I'll put this one up this week as a pod. Patreon.com/mygoodbadbrain.
Welcome to my good bad brain. I'm a normal person, so I'm insane. I've got depression and ADHD, but I'm doing better since I medicated me. I'm still not always sure whether I exist or what being a person even really is, but I figured out a long time ago that being alive is beautiful.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.